That is pretty impressive. But 400 metres is nothing compared to the depths that we can now explore thanks to manned and unmanned deep sea subs. The deepest manned dive went nearly 11 kilometres down. But there's a whole host of challenges associated with being several kilometres below the ocean's surface, both for the research vehicles and if you're one of the marine creatures or microbes the vehicle has been sent to collect. I went to Scripps Institution of Oceanography to speak to Professor of Marine Microbial Genetics, Professor Douglas Bartlett, and engineer extraordinaire Kevin Hardy to find out more. Here's Professor Bartlett.
There's so much diversity of microbial life in the ocean in general, and especially in the deep sea, and we just don't know a lot of what's there. So there's all this biology that's just waiting to be explored. And so we've been taken up with that. I have been told of this quote that came out of the Census for Marine Microbial Life, that there's the equivalent of, I think it's something like 35 full-grown African elephants worth of microbes for every man, woman, and child on the planet. And most of those microbes in the ocean are in the deep ocean, maybe not in extreme deep ocean environments, but found at depth. And so there's a lot of diversity of life down there. We're interested in the adaptations of microbial life to deep ocean settings because they're so different. They're dark. The way microbes get nutrients in the deep ocean is very different from that in surface waters. They're adapted to low temperatures as a rule, and they're adapted to high hydrostatic pressure. And it's this last parameter, high pressure, that we've really been focusing on. And it would be wonderful to be able to get those organisms into culture to more easily do biochemistry and genetics. It'd also be useful to look at their genomes and do culture-independent molecular analyses, and to look at processes like CO2 fixation and other biogeochemical cycles.
So if you look at something like a bacterium or a microorganism, something that's very small, do they face different challenges from the high pressure than something like a larger-bodied animal?
The general problems that a microbe would face would be very similar to the cells of any organism, an invertebrate or a vertebrate. It all has to do with high pressure influences on volume changes of equilibria and of activation. So biochemical processes are very different under high pressure, and all organisms are going to face that issue.
And so how do they get around these issues? What adaptations have they come up with that help them solve it?
The most well-studied adaptation has to do with membrane lipids. The membrane lipids of deep ocean organisms, fish to bacteria, are loaded with highly unsaturated fatty acids. And that's critical to keeping the membrane in the right physical state, a semi-liquid state, so that it can function for transport and for energetics and for other processes.
So how exactly do you go and retrieve samples of these things? Is that what you do? You go and then you bring them back and study them in the lab? Do you ever, I guess you can't really necessarily study them in situ because you just kind of look at them and you think, I don't really know what's going on there.
Yeah, it's hard to explore microbial activities and processes in situ, but that's a growing area of development in the ocean sciences that is coming up with more autonomous instruments that allow you to go where you need to go and to measure those parameters that you'd like to measure. But what we usually do is we work with an engineer here at Scripps who comes up with these wonderful untethered toys that can be deployed from relatively small ocean craft and sink all the way down to the deepest ocean depth and can be used to collect water samples and mud and to collect animals using beta traps and things like that. And after a prescribed time, will release their ballast, close the doors of whatever it is that they're sampling, seawater or animals like crustaceans, and come back up to the surface. And we get those samples at the surface, and then we process them. So far, it's been valuable. We've been getting new kinds of microbes, in some cases not just new species or genera of microbes, but even new subphyla and phyla of microbes coming up that hadn't been cultured previously from deep ocean environments.
And finally, I spotted earlier that little tiny polystyrene cup on your windowsill. Is that something that was taken down in one of these little unmanned subs?
What a great question. I don't even remember where this came from. It either came from one of those small untethered instruments, or it looks like in this case it came from a dive with the Alvin submersible.
I see.
And so that probably went down just a couple kilometers in depth. But some of these instruments that we deploy have been used at depths as great as 9 kilometers or so.
So, I mean, this is, I'm guessing it was once a sort of normal-sized polystyrene cup, and it's now sort of the size of a very small egg cup. It's an illustration of the pressures that we're looking at, I suppose.
It is. This is a perfect example of how high pressure promotes volume decreases, and it does that to a styrofoam cup. But at high pressure, the styrofoam cups get compressed to something like ceramic and greatly decreased in size.
So I suppose that is a great illustration of the problems that microbes like that face in the deep sea.
It is, and also for people who want to deploy instruments in the deep ocean, because everything has to be designed so that it can cope with high pressure. So pressure housings are necessary for every component of equipment that gets deployed down deep, and whether it's a manned submersible or an autonomous instrument or some cabled array, it all has to be pressure resistant.
Well, speaking of taking stuff down to the deep ocean and how exactly we go about looking at all the microbes and all the life down there, we're now joined by Kevin Hardy. Kevin, hello.
Hi.
So I hear that you have quite a lot of exciting gadgets and instruments that you might be able to show us.
We have some of the tools of science that get us down to the deepest ocean depths, so just across the hall.
Let's go. Wow, this is quite an exciting room full of gadgets and big yellow spheres. What exactly am I looking at here?
This here is actually one of our deep ocean vehicles. It's a small 17-inch outside diameter glass sphere with an acoustic transponder up on top so we can acoustically communicate with it at depth, and gives us about 54 pounds of buoyancy as well as command control. So that gives us a payload capability, which means we can haul stuff down to the deep ocean.
And then haul stuff back up, I guess.
And then haul stuff back up, yeah. It should be a round trip. So we have one of our frames right here. We actually try to use fiberglass reinforced plastic, FRP, because the water weight is so much lighter. And then we attach plastic bottles onto here. So even though it looks large, underwater really weighs nothing, so we can carry large volumes of water back to the surface.
Well, it's quite noisy in here, so should we take a couple of your exciting gadgets back to the office and we can have a look at them?
Sure.
in more depth, as it were. Oh, fantastic pun there.
So we have a few things we do. Each of the vehicles is a composite of a variety of technologies. And we're experimenting with some new ideas. These are lithium-ion batteries, which are actually really cool because they're vacuum-packed. And you can see that there's really, it's sort of like those Ziploc bags that hold a jelly sandwich.
Oh, yeah. So, that's pretty small. I mean, it's kind of, 3 or 4 inches long, about an inch wide. So, I mean, how much power does that sort of thing give out?
Yes, this will give us quite a bit, actually. It's almost 12 volts at about 2 amp hours. So you can really pack a lot of punch. But the other great thing about this, you can package these in an oil environment, so they're pressure compensated. And we've done that and run them down to pressures greater than the deepest ocean depths. So the advantage to us is we can put these outside, and we never have to open up those glass spheres that you saw on board of a small ship. So it makes turnaround very easy. So we're excited about that, because rather than bringing water up to be processed on the ship, we can bring our little factory with us down to the seafloor and leave it down there for a long period of time, and actually get a lot more of the microbes that we're looking for.
So obviously pressure is something that these are calibrated for. Is pressure the major problem that we look at when we're going down to study the deep sea?
Yeah, it's really the first order problem, because that'll affect your buoyancy. So it's really a buoyancy game. It's like having a lift to the deep sea. So we can put a big anchor on these things, send them down, and we have to design them to either tolerate pressure or to be stronger than the pressure. But once you're down there, it's actually pretty benign. Temperatures are fairly constant. There's no light to deal with. Currents are pretty nominal. Corrosion's one of the problems we have to deal with, sort of a secondary problem. But, those things are easily engineered around. So we've got some experience doing this. So some of the problems remain the same. The core extraction problem is the one where we go down to get sediments from the seafloor. It's well known that it's like trying to take a core sample out of peanut butter. You know, it really plunge in a core tube and you pull it out, and it really has a lot of adhesion. So one of the techniques that was first proposed in 1960 was by a guy named David Moore here in San Diego. And that was actually a technique where you take a steel core tube and it's lined with a plastic sleeve.
Oh, I see. So this is kind of, it's almost like a drain pipe kind of size metal tube we've got here. And it's surrounded by this sort of rather sturdy looking load of plastic rings and things. So how exactly does this work?
Well, this is really great because what he decided to do was rather than fight the seafloor, he was going to give it up. And what he did was he took this steel tube and it would go down to the seafloor, hit the bottom, and then the mud would push up on this release and it would leave the steel tube behind.
Oh.
And it would actually draw out the plastic liner. And so you leave a steel casement in the bottom, which is actually rusts away in a short period of time, and it's fairly cheap. That works out actually pretty well, especially for free vehicles where you only have a limited amount of buoyancy.
So I guess it's one of the problems is it's not just being able to get the sample into your machine, it's being able to get the machine off the seafloor again, because I guess it's kind of like getting stuck in that goopy mud at the beach where you get your feet stuck and you can't get out and you're sort of making that sort of splatchy noise, but you're obviously under so much pressure under the sea as well, so I guess it's kind of a bit of a problem.
It is. Some of the core samples that are done have a line that goes all the way back up to the ship with a big powerful winch. They can haul this thing with hundreds of pounds. But with the free vehicles, which are really just remote vehicles that go down on their own, all you have on board is the buoyancy you have, which might only be, you know, on the order of 40 or 50 pounds. And so we had to become a little more clever about how to get our vehicle back.
And is this still a system that's used today? Do you still use it today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we just use it on the Philippine Sea. It's been used down in Fiji. It's really the best way to go, I think. It's still something of the holy grail for us to really get this working perfectly every time. But once we do that, we have microbial scientists working here on new medicines from the sea, both antibiotics and actually cancer cure drugs, and they really need to harvest the sediments to find those animals. And so they're very good at that. I'm very good at this. Together we can do things that really help mankind.
And we're talking about all these untethered, unmanned vehicles, but have either of you ever been down inside something like the Alvin submersible, where I guess you're packed into those tiny little room? Have either of you ever been down in one of those?
I have. I've been down on a few dives in the Alvin, and it's a wonderful experience looking out that porthole. And in my case, we were looking at cold seeps off the northwest coast of the United States. Beautiful trip. It's cramped in there, as you indicated, that, you know, three people crammed in an uncomfortable position, everybody trying to look out a porthole window. And there are real advantages to being right there when it comes to sampling and thinking about the science that you're going to do.
And I've been down in a couple of smaller submarines, not the Alvin, and it's quite an experience, a firsthand observation. Roger Revell, our former director, once said that instruments will only see what you tell them to look for. So if you're measuring temperature, that's what you get. So having the human eye behind the porthole is really, really pretty nice. The great thing about free vehicles, unmanned vehicles, is their persistence. They can stay down there quite a long time, 2 years perhaps, you know, if you want to let them study, you know, the entire annual cycle of the deep ocean, you can do that. Whereas manned vehicles, their great advantage is the human eye and their mobility. We're picking up some more mobility with AUVs, which are good for like a first order solution to survey a large area. But I think still that there's quite a bit of opportunity for man observation down deep.
You definitely see them as a complementary pairing of manned and unmanned, not a kind of, in the future, you think we'll still see both types?
Yeah, agreed.
You definitely think so? It's going to be a combination. I mean, I guess because you're developing technologies to do with sending these instruments down there, from a personal design point of view, do you feel that the sort of things that you end up working on are going to be for manned vehicles or unmanned vehicles?
Well, I think there are crossovers, like a Venn diagram where they apply to both. Certain things work better in a manned vehicle. Other things I think work better for unmanned vehicles. But I think my head is definitely underwater. And I think, you know, once you've been there and you live in that 3D world, it becomes easier to be an engineer to design for that. So I think it's really an exciting place to be. It's a whole other planet. It's a whole other Earth. Things happen there that don't happen. Topside, spreading centers, subduction zones, all sorts of weird and strange animals, many of which we've yet to find. Every time we go down with a camera, we find something brand new. With samplers, we find something brand new. Still a remarkable place to go.
That was Kevin Hardy, and before him, Professor Douglas Bartlett from Scripps Institution of Oceanography. I'm not sure how keen I personally would be to go down in something like the Alvin sub. How about you, Helen? Yeah, I'm kind of torn. A bit claustrophobic, but also it would be amazing, wouldn't it, to see all the life down there and just to be in the deep sea and to know you've been there, and it would be fantastic. But so far, no one's offered, so I haven't actually had to decide on that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a toss-up between scientific excitement and personal fears of being underwater and claustrophobia. Ooh, I don't know. Well, if you'd like to hear more from Douglas Bartlett and Kevin Hardy, there's a longer version of that interview at thenakedscientist.com/specials.
Are there really plenty more fish in the sea? Find out with Naked Oceans on the web at nakedscientist.com/oceans.